A note before we begin. Due to the nature of this story, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of substance misuse, mental health, and murder. Consider this when deciding how and when you'll listen. To get help on mental health and addiction, visit spotify.com/resources. It says a lot about a person when their story includes underground vampire clubs and the Russian mafia, but they are still the most fascinating part. Today, I'm talking about a woman who moved between many different worlds. She was a mother, a go-go dancer, and a journalist covering New York's kink scene. She changed like a chameleon to access spaces most journalists couldn't. Like many writers, she walked the line between reality and pretend. She wanted something bigger, something exciting, and she worked every angle to get there. Her loved ones say she was friendly, maybe too friendly. But if you want people to trust you with their secrets, they have to like you. But as Susan kept changing for others, she got lost along the way. I'm Sarah Turney, and this is Disappearances, a Spotify podcast. Every Thursday, I examine a new missing person case ripped from history. I want to better understand the many reasons people disappear and the impact their absences can have on those left behind. Today, I'd like you to meet a writer whose own story still deserves an ending, the real woman inside a web of salacious theories. Her name is Susan Walsh.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement.
Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
July 16th, 1996. Susan Walsh is living in Nutley, New Jersey, a commuter suburb a train away from New York City and all the potential it offers. Susan enjoys a slow morning with her 11-year-old son, who I'll call Jason. Her boyfriend Christian is asleep in the apartment. Around noon, Susan reportedly tells Jason she has to run an errand and needs to use a payphone down the street. She'll be right back. According to her boyfriend Christian, she can't use the landline in her house because it had been turned off. She hasn't paid the bill. Before she leaves, she drops Jason off with his father, Susan's ex-husband Mark. She asks Mark to watch Jason for a bit while she goes out to make that call. Susan and Mark have an unconventional co-parenting arrangement. They live in the same home, divided into Susan's upstairs and Mark's downstairs apartment, so they see each other often. Susan's one of those people who maybe has trouble letting go of jobs or men, and she struggled with addiction and drug misuse. That's part of the reason Susan doesn't just use the phone in Mark's apartment. He suspects Susan's using drugs again, and he won't let her make calls from his place if he thinks she's contacting a dealer. But Susan's 36 and has the right to call anyone she wants, so she heads upstairs, says goodbye to Christian, and then walks down the street to a payphone. At least that's what everyone believes she's doing. It's what they'll tell police later. Meanwhile, unbeknownst to Susan, a different phone call is already underway. Her best friend, Melissa, is organizing a mini intervention. According to the docuseries Disappeared, Susan's loved ones are aware she's backsliding and want to help however they can. Melissa and another friend decide today's the day, so Melissa pages Susan to plan a meetup, but an hour or so goes by without a response. It's weird, and given the circumstances, Melissa's concerned. She drives over to Susan's apartment and tries to get in through the back, but all the doors and windows are shut, which is maybe unexpected given it's a hot summer day and the Walshes don't have air conditioning. Melissa leaves and comes back to Susan's place an hour later, sometime after 2 p.m. When she gets there, Mark and Jason are walking up to the apartment and they haven't seen Susan. According to Susan's son, he and Susan's current boyfriend Christian watched a movie together at the apartment until 12:45-ish. At some point after that, he sent Jason downstairs to hang out with his dad, and around 1:45, Christian left to grab a bus into the city. Around 3 o'clock, another friend shows up to take Susan to the bar where she dances. He's known to give her rides every now and again. He waits outside of Susan's apartment for an hour, but she's a no-show. Now, everyone's growing concerned. Susan's loved ones page her all night. The next day, Mark reports Susan missing to Nutley police. When police search Susan's apartment, they find her wallet, beeper, and cigarettes on the counter, suggesting she probably planned on returning. They also find a wall calendar that is meticulously filled out with appointments, but the month of July is missing. Police wonder if there's something on that page that Susan or someone else didn't want them to see. Thanks to Susan's career paths, the list of possible suspects could fill a room. Almost immediately, police rule out both Mark and Christian as suspects and move on to her past partners. Remember how I said boyfriend stuck to Susan? Well, according to her boyfriend Christian, Susan's exes showed up at their door more than one time during their relationship. They still wanted her, or the idea of her. Christian says the interactions usually ended with him getting into a fist fight. The police look into the exes, but Christian thinks they don't look hard enough. Christian says the worst of Susan's exes is a man named Billy. In an episode of the docuseries Never Seen Again, he said Billy claimed to have ties to organized crime. There are rumors of violence and excessive drug use in his past. Just a few weeks before she disappeared, Susan felt Billy was stalking her. According to Christian, she just couldn't get away from him. He kept calling her and turning up. Before she disappeared, Christian says Susan hatched a plan to rid herself of Billy once and for all. One day, when his mob friends came into the bar where Susan danced, she planned to turn them against Billy and get him killed. This is all according to Christian, who says he begged Susan not to go through with the plot. He worried the mob would kill her too. How serious was the plan? Did it actually exist? Police say there's no one else to corroborate Christian's account, but we can say with certainty, Susan filed a restraining order against Billy that summer. On July 15, 1996, Susan sat down for an interview on a documentary about exotic dancers called Stripped. Susan was both a dancer herself and an expert on the world from her reporting work, which I'll get into later. The important thing here is, during the interview, she jokes about having a stalker. Except it doesn't seem like a joke. The whole interview, she has dark bags under her eyes. She looks absolutely exhausted. But a stalker isn't the only angle police were working. Let's rewind to 1993, 3 years before Susan went missing. Susan worked as a go-go dancer and had for nearly a decade while writing on the side. She'd always wanted to be a writer ever since she was a teenager, but take it from the writers on my staff, it's not an easy career to break into. By 1993, Susan had made inroads with technical writing, and most recently selling sexual stories to a magazine about the sex industry called Screw. That year, Screw's editor introduced her to a man who became her mentor, James Ridgway, a journalist at The Village Voice, the legendary New York publication founded in 1955. For the past year or so, James and his writing partner had been trying to construct a book on the sex industry. The trouble was, James couldn't find sex workers willing to be interviewed. Because Susan was trying to become a writer, she was more than willing to help James out. In exchange, he gave her a job. She began working with James, helping him make contacts in the sex industry. The situation was thrilling for Susan. Between working for James and writing for Screw, she was making ends meet as a writer and could imagine quitting dancing entirely. Plus, Susan was great at her new job. James said she was the, quote, most dependable person I've ever worked with. Whenever she said she was going to do something, she did it. If it was hard to find somebody, she'd go find them. But she never failed. Ever. On August 2, 1994, James and Susan published their first article together. It included allegations of a sex trafficking ring at local Russian-owned go-go clubs. It told the stories of several Russian-born dancers who were classically trained. Each one was told they could immigrate from Russia to New York to dance professionally. They only realized the bait and switch after they arrived. Without any money to return home, they were forced into sex work and exotic dancing. The article was a success, and soon Susan was hired to work on a German documentary about the same subject. Now, this seemed to be what Susan loved about her job, diving even deeper into this subject. But even more than that, she wanted to bring justice to the young women being trafficked. She'd found the kind of career where she could make a difference. But it could also put her in serious danger. It's June 1996, about a month before Susan Walsh disappears. At this point, Susan believes she's in danger. First, from the ex she had to take out a restraining order on, and second, from the Russian mob, after her work as a journalist exposed their underground sex trafficking. She feels the eyes on her. That month, there's even more attention on Susan than before, because the book she and her mentor James Ridgway had been working on for 3 years finally comes out. The book's called Red Light: Inside the Sex Industry. Susan is credited as the primary researcher on the book and has some of her personal photographs and writings featured in the text. According to friends and colleagues, she beams as she invites them to the book launch. The party is a culmination of her work with James, and she's a guest of honor. But there's something else happening underneath all the sheen. That night, Susan tells a friend she's worried about her safety. She also claims that she was twice threatened by the mafia, whom she exposed through her reporting. When the police find out about this, they investigate, but come up empty-handed. Detective Lieutenant Steve Rogers of the Nutley Police Department says there's no evidence that the Russian mafia had a contract out on Susan. Of course, that doesn't mean Susan didn't consider the threats real. So officials move on to another theory. Susan voluntarily disappeared in an act of self-preservation. Maybe she's hiding out somewhere, fearing for her safety. While the police investigate, her loved ones continue their own search. A couple weeks after Susan goes missing, they hang missing person flyers all over town. But it doesn't have the desired effect. A lot of people don't take it seriously. Because of Susan's career and the recent launch of Red Light, they think the flyers are a clever promotion for her book. It's not until mid-August that Susan's disappearance hits the news, and people realize it's not a publicity stunt. And at that point, the news focuses on another subject Susan covered. Vampires. Stay with me. In the summer of 1995, a year before James's book was published and a year before she disappeared, Susan got a new assignment at the Village Voice, and it felt like a major career move. For the first time ever, she wouldn't be reporting on sex work. The assignment stemmed from a tip about a growing subculture in New York City, self-identified vampires. Allegedly, some of them were stealing blood from local hospitals. Susan believed she might even uncover a murder. While on the beat, Susan proved adept at immersing herself in the subculture, blending in at vampire bars and nightclubs. But for all her legwork, she couldn't find any evidence to support the tips about theft or homicide. The closest thing to illicit behavior she found was that yes, some self-proclaimed vampires did drink blood straight from other people, but it was all consensual. For some, it was a nuanced, almost sub-dom kind of relationship, a kink. For others, it was a lifestyle. And yet, even though there was no crime to report, Susan found herself too fascinated with this world to leave. She continued poking around, and even started dating a self-identified vampire. There was some kind of story here. She knew it. But when Susan finally submitted her article to the Village Voice, it fell flat. James later told a reporter, quote, "She got totally absorbed with the vampire thing. The theories, the energy flows. The article she wrote wasn't very astute." The Village Voice declined to publish it, and that had to be a blow for Susan. Her big push to take the next step in her career failed. Over the next few months, James noticed that Susan wasn't her usual self. It was a subtle change, but it didn't sit right with him. Probably because he knew Susan had dealt with a bunch of stressful situations over the past decade. In the early 80s, Susan was a student at William Patterson University, studying English and communications, and writing for the college newspaper, The Beacon. One day in 1984, Susan approached her editor at The Beacon with a problem. She said she was being stalked by her ex-lover, whom she believed was an agent in the CIA. Later that year, Susan left college. Like I mentioned before, it's not easy to get started as a writer. Susan needed a survival job, one she could do without a college degree that would leave her enough time and energy to write, which led her to her first gig in the sex industry, dancing at a go-go bar. Susan didn't have any trouble finding work or making tips. She was instantly popular with clients. She's tall and slender, with a curtain of blonde hair. One colleague said she didn't look like the usual dancer, but she had no trouble playing the role and commanding the stage. At first, Susan liked the attention. She felt powerful on stage, but it also takes a lot of vulnerability to dance in a go-go bar. And after a while, maybe after a couple gritty run-ins with disrespectful clientele, Susan lost her enthusiasm. She started drinking to cope, and on Christmas Eve 1984, the police picked her up for drug possession. Susan called her dad from jail. I imagine it was a long drive back to her childhood home that night, but the ordeal seemed to be the wake-up call Susan needed. She checked herself into rehab and stayed for 2 months. Once she was out, Susan stopped her drinking and drug use, but she did go back to dancing. She needed the cash. This becomes a pattern in Susan's life. She wants to move on from dancing, but the pay keeps her in. She starts to find writing work, but then she becomes a mom and has to find a way to provide for her child. Her writing career takes off, and she gets into a master's program at NYU, but it's expensive. Susan worked day and night to get the life she dreamed of, but it felt like sex work was an inescapable part of that puzzle. By 1996, Susan was reportedly working in a club as often as 6 days a week. Sometimes she pulled double shifts in the same day. According to James Ridgway, Susan basically used strip clubs as an ATM machine. If she was in the city and didn't have enough money to get on the train home, she'd stop into a club and dance until she made 10 bucks for ticket fare. This worried her friends. One night, James got a call from Susan asking for help. She was stuck out in Staten Island somewhere without any money. He just thought, "Susan, what are you doing?" This wasn't the ambitious professional he hired. And he wasn't the only one to notice Susan's behavior. Susan's half-brother, Arthur, recalled that back in 1995, their dad warned him Susan may be relapsing. He was right. Susan was drinking again. Susan confirmed as much herself in that strip documentary interview a year later. The same one where she talked about being stalked. On camera, she admits to losing 11 years of sobriety, though she doesn't mention drug use, just drinking. She says it's way too painful to be a dancer while sober. She talks about experiencing downswings and becoming disenchanted with the industry. As that summer went on, Arthur noticed that Susan was scattered. In a 2020 interview with NorthJersey.com, he recalls a frustrating phone call from around that time. She was distracted. It felt like having a conversation with two different people. One second she was telling him that she was headed to Vegas soon to help the FBI or CIA with a case. The next, she was saying she's tired and just wants to watch Roseanne. The call left Arthur frustrated, and Arthur wasn't the only one who heard Susan talk about the CIA around this time. Susan's best friend Melissa said, quote, "Susan was addicted to the fantasy part of her life. She had a friend that claimed he belonged to the CIA. He was playing the role that she wanted to hear. He turned out to be working for a trucking company. She needed a lot of help." The last time Susan mentioned the CIA, she was under a lot of stress. Her friends assumed she was going through a similar kind of burnout between the book launch, working on her master's, and being a single mom. And on top of all of that, her physical health was failing. Susan had emphysema, an ulcer, and chronic bronchitis. All of this leads to a darker theory. Journalist Sandy Tolan, who spoke with those who knew Susan, told This American Life, quote, "Most of the people who knew her well believe she died of a drug overdose, and whoever she was with panicked and disposed of her body." It's worth noting that Sandy said this in 1997, less than a year after Susan disappeared. At that time, the theory made a lot of sense. But over two decades, you'd hope that if this happened, the person who hid Susan's body would have come forward by now. But it was a prevailing theory at the time she disappeared, and I mention it because it did impact the way Susan's case was handled. Sandy also told This American Life that a week or so after Susan vanished, a detective implied Susan went missing as a result of her life as a dancer. According to Sandy, he essentially said she was probably out partying, and it took police learning she was a journalist on assignment for them to launch a major investigation. Had they realized that earlier, would the investigators have handled Susan's case differently? Maybe. But once they put the puzzle pieces together, the tips are darker than anyone imagined. Unfortunately, when Susan Walsh disappears in July 1996, it takes a while for authorities and media to take her case seriously. On the surface, she's a missing sex worker with a history of addiction. She spent her time around mobsters and self-proclaimed vampires. For the most part, the headlines are salacious. They miss the fact that she's also a single mother and a journalist whose beat may have put her in danger. The only silver lining is that the widespread publicity brings in dozens of tips. Many suggest that Susan is alive, living on the streets, battling a full-fledged addiction, and selling herself to survive. A sex worker in Newark, New Jersey, tells police that Susan had been living with her for a few weeks in late July and early August. Importantly, one detective notes she knows facts about Susan that hadn't been in the papers. According to this woman, Susan didn't want to go home, that if the police made her come home, she'd end her own life, which leads police to believe that Susan disappeared of her own accord. I'll say it's a hard story to ignore, especially because according to Susan's friend Melissa, the one who wanted to stage the intervention, Susan had been talking about making big changes in her life. She dreamed of moving to Florida with her cousins to make a better life for her son. She may have even found a new job there. It was a clean slate. She'd get out of dancing and end her financial troubles. That said, Melissa says she has a hard time believing the story and threatening self-harm if she was forced to return home. Susan's loved ones believe there's no way she'd leave her son. By every firsthand account, she was an outstanding and devoted mother. They worry that the police are devaluing Susan's case because of her background. Authorities deny that's true. They say they've devoted hundreds of hours to Susan's case and done basically everything they can. Susan's case went cold in December 1996. At that time, police believed she was still alive. In the decade following Susan's disappearance, filmmaker Jill Morley and author Catherine Ramsland have independently investigated the vampire subculture and Russian-owned go-go bars, hoping they'd find new information on Susan's disappearance. Neither woman uncovered anything substantial. But in 2005, Detective Lieutenant Rogers reopened Susan's case. Finally, after so many years of dead ends, the needle moved a little. Rogers discovered a piece of evidence that he believes links Susan to a new romantic partner, previously unknown to Nutley police. Not Billy, and not anyone they'd spoken to before. Because this is still an open investigation, that's all we know. Apparently, Rogers also found a letter Susan left for her son sometime before she disappeared. It said, "And if ever something should happen to me, please know how much I love you." Perhaps further reinforcing that Susan felt she was in danger. In 2013, at the time he was interviewed for the docuseries Disappeared, Detective Lieutenant Rogers was hopeful that they'd soon have answers. As of this recording, it seems like the official police case has stalled out again, but progress could be coming. In September 2020, Susan's half-brother Arthur filed a lawsuit against the Nutley Police Department, seeking information about his sister's disappearance. Susan's family also hired a PI, who reportedly turned over some new findings to police. In February 2022, a New Jersey Superior Court ordered the disclosure of Susan's records. But the Nutley police haven't released them yet, stating they're exempt from the order because Susan's case is still considered open. As of right now, we still don't know the plans Susan had for July 1996. That missing page from her calendar hasn't been recovered yet, and no one's been named as a suspect or charged in connection with Susan's disappearance, including all the people and groups we've mentioned. But the theories continue to swirl. Stalkers, mobsters, CIA plots, drug overdoses, running away, each suggesting a very different story of Susan Walsh's final months. And that's the crux of the issue here. Even after she disappeared, Susan has remained a chameleon. But I hope that moving forward, Susan's case can overcome the sensationalism. Because if you look past it, you find a loving, caring, ambitious woman who knew she was in danger and seemed to be asking for help. But because of the stigma around her work, she didn't have her fears properly acknowledged. Until maybe it was too late. As I mentioned, this case is still considered open. If you have information about Susan Walsh's disappearance, please call the Essex County Prosecutor's Office tips line at 1-877-847-7432. Thank you for listening. In the time it took you to listen to this episode, 30 people disappeared in the United States alone. For more information on Susan Walsh, among the many sources we used, we found episodes from Disappeared, Never Seen Again, and This American Life extremely helpful to our research. If you or someone you know needs assistance with a missing persons case, please visit seasonofjustice.org. Season of Justice is a nonprofit organization that provides funding to law enforcement agencies and families to help solve cold cases. For full disclosure, I am a member of the board. It's a great resource for both law enforcement and families in order to bring closure to those impacted by unsolved violent crime. You can find all episodes of Disappearances and all other Spotify podcasts for free on Spotify. This episode was written by Aaron Lan and Maggie Admire, edited by Maggie Admire, researched by Brian Petrus, fact-checked by Lori Siegel, with sound design by Alex Button. Our head of programming is Julian Bravo. Our head of production is Nick Johnson, and Spencer Howard is our post-production supervisor. I'm your host, Sarah Turney. To hear more stories hosted by me, check out my other podcast, Voices for Justice.